You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. And what an hour it is, and what a time it is, ladies and gentlemen. We are living, literally, in one of the great turning points of history. And the future is going to be one of the most magnificent, wonderful events that has ever transpired. Or we are going to slide backwards into the darkest, most dismal slavery that the world has ever known. And everyone knows that there is something terribly wrong, but only a few of us are able to put our finger on it, give it a name, and point the finger at those responsible. Don't go away. I'll be right back, and we will continue with part two of our book report on Bloodline of the Holy Grail, The Hidden Lineage of Jesus Revealed by Lawrence Gardner, with a foreword by Prince Michael of Albany. We left off yesterday where Lawrence Gardner was building the case for the world to accept a Messiah King from the Bloodline that he and other orders of the Illuminati claim is a direct descendant through Jesus Christ to the legendary and biblical House of David, which was given the divine right to rule by God. The only problem, as I pointed out yesterday, is in his doing this, it is one of the more successful attempts at getting people to disregard the legitimacy of the Holy Bible or Christianity, because that is the target. Now, in presenting this broadcast, I am not defending the Bible or Christianity. I'm merely pointing out one of the more successful agendas of the Illuminati in destroying all existing nation states, all existing religions save theirs, and the bringing about of the shackling of the mob, the profane. That's you, in case you wondered. In the birth of a new world order, a one world totalitarian socialist government. We left off yesterday when they're bringing the role of the United States into all of this. And you're going to find it extremely interesting if you really care about learning what's going on in the world, what's driving it, and who's responsible. If you don't know those things, you certainly can't fight the battle. You don't even know where the battlefield is at or who the enemy is. They're just running around bumping into each other. And that spells death for any military or army or people that I have ever studied in history. So let me back up just one paragraph so that we at least overlap a little bit. Remember, this is a book report. I'm just reading to you a little bit, very tiny bit of this book called The Bloodline of the Holy Grail, The Hidden Lineage of Jesus Revealed by Lawrence Gardner, with a foreword by Prince Michael of Albany. Lawrence Gardner is the prior of the Celtic Church's Sacred Kindred of St. Columba, is an internationally known sovereign and chivalric genealogist. He is distinguished as the Chevalier Labron de Saint-Germain. He is presidential attaché to the European Council of Princes, which is a constitutional advisory body established in 1946. He is formally attached to the noble household guard of the Royal House of Stuart, founded at Saint-Germain-en-Laye in 1692. And get this, folks, he is the Jacobite historiographer royal, which means he's responsible for the royal history of the Illuminati. So you better listen to what this man has to say. And I'm quoting directly from the book. A popular alternative to absolute monarchy or dictatorship has been found in republicanism. The Republic of the United States was created primarily to free the emergent nation from the despotism of Britain's House of Hanover. Yet its citizens still tend to be fascinated by the concept of monarchy. No matter how republican the spirit, the need for a central symbol remains. Neither a flag nor a president can fulfill this unifying role, for by virtue of the party system, presidents are always politically motivated. Republicanism was devised on the principle of fraternal status. Yet an ideally classless society can never exist in an environment that promotes displays of eminence and superiority by degrees of wealth and possession. Now here you have a clue of what he's really leading to, folks, because nobody ever said that this was supposed to be a classless society or a classless nation. What the Founding Father says, all men are created equal. They should have the same opportunities, the same rights. It doesn't mean that they have the same ability, the same intelligence, or that they're going to rise to the same level or station in life or in society. But it gave us the opportunity to do that. He talks about an ideally classless society, which confirms everything I've been telling you about the heart and soul of these people being socialist communists. He continues, for the most part, and listen to this very carefully because it confirms everything that I've been teaching you, for the most part, those responsible for the United States' morally inspired constitution were Rosicrucians and Freemasons. Notable characters such as George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and Charles Thompson. The last, who designed the Great Seal of the United States of America, was a member of Franklin's American Philosophical Society, a counterpart of Britain's Invisible College. The imagery of the seal is directly related to alchemical tradition, inherited from the allegory of the ancient Egyptian therapeutate. The eagle, the olive branch, the arrows, and the pentagrams are all occult symbols of opposites, good and evil, male and female, war and peace, darkness and light. On the reverse, as repeated on the dollar bill, is the truncated pyramid, indicating the loss of the old wisdom, severed and forced underground by the church establishment. But above this are the rays of ever-hopeful light, incorporating the all-seeing eye, used as a symbol during the French Revolution. In establishing their republic, the Americans could still not escape the ideal of a parallel monarchy, a central focus of non-political patriotic attachment. George Washington was actually offered kingship, but declined because he had no immediately qualifying heritage. Instead, he turned to the royal house of Stuart. In November of 1782, four Americans arrived in the San Clemente Palazzo in Florence, the residence of Charles III, Stuart in exile. They were Mr. Galloway of Maryland, two brothers named Sylvester from Pennsylvania, and Mr. Fish, a lawyer from New York. They were taken to Charles Edward by his secretary, John Stuart. Also present was the Honorable Charles Hervey Townsend, later Britain's ambassador to The Hague, and the prince's future wife, Marguerite, Comtesse de Massillon. The interview, which revolved around the contemporary transatlantic dilemma, is documented in the United States Senate Archives and in the Manor-Water Papers. Writers such as Sir Compton Mackenzie and Sir Charles Petrie have also described the occasion when Charles Edward Stuart was invited to become King of the Americans. Some years earlier, Charles had been similarly approached by the men of Boston, but once the War of Independence was over, George Washington sent his own envoys. It would have been a great irony for the House of Hanover to lose the North American colonies to the Stuarts, but Charles declined the offer for a number of reasons, not the least of which was his lack of a legitimate male heir at the time. He knew that without a due successor, the United States could easily fall to Hanover again at his death, thereby defeating the whole independence effort. Since those days, many other radical events have taken place. The French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, two major world wars, and a host of changes as countries have swapped one style of government for another. Meanwhile, civil and international disputes continue, just as they did in the Middle Ages. They're motivated by trade, politics, religion, and whatever other banners are flown to justify the constant struggle for territorial and economic control. The Holy Roman Empire has disappeared, the German Reichs have failed, and the British Empire has collapsed. The Russian Empire fell to communism, which has itself been disgraced and crumbles to ruin, while capitalism teeters on the very brink of acceptability. With the Cold War now ended, America faces a new threat to her super power status from the Pacific countries. In the meantime, the nations of Europe band together in what was once a seemingly well-conceived economic community, but which is already suffering from the same pressures of individual custom and national sovereignty that beset the Holy Roman Empire. Whether nations are governed by military-style regimes, are elected parliaments by autocrats or democrats, and whether formally described as monarchist, socialist, or republican, the net product is always the same. The few control the fate of the many. In situations of dictatorship, this is a natural experience, but it should not be the case in a democratic institution based on the principle of majority vote. True democracy is government by the people, for the people. in either direct or representative form, ignoring class distinctions and tolerating minority views. The American Constitution sets out an ideal for this form of democracy, but in line with other nations, there is always a large sector of the community that is not represented by the party in power. Because presidents and prime ministers are politically tied, and because political parties take their respective turns at individual helms, the inevitable result is a lack of continuity for the nations concerned. This is not necessarily a bad thing, but there is no reliable ongoing institution to champion the civil rights and liberties of people in such conditions of ever-changing leadership. Britain does, at least, retain a monarchy, but it is a politically constrained monarchy, and as such is ineffectual in performing its role as guardian of the nation. The United States, unlike Britain, has a written constitution, but has no one with the power to uphold its principles against successive governments who determinedly pursue their own politically vested interests. Is there an answer to the anomaly? An answer that could bring not just a ray of hope, but a shining light for the future? There certainly is. But its energy relies on those in governmental service appreciating their roles as representatives of society, rather than presuming to stand at the head of society. Alongside the political administration, an appointed constitutional champion would be empowered to keep check on any potential disparities and infringements of the Constitution that might occur. This can be achieved in the manner first envisioned by George Washington and the American Fathers. Their original plan was for a democratic parliament combined with a working constitutional monarchy bound not to parliament or the church, but to the people and their written constitution. In such an environment, sovereignty would ultimately rest with the people, while the monarch, as an operative guardian of the realm, would pledge an oath of fealty to the nation, not the reverse, as in Britain's case, whereby the nation pays homage to the sovereignty of Parliament and the monarchy. You're listening to The Hour of the Time with yours truly, William Cooper, on 101.1 FM, Eager, Arizona. The Hour of the Time is broadcast worldwide on WRMI, 9.955 MHz, International Shortwave Radio. The unfulfilled ambition of the American fathers was that government ministers should be elected by the majority vote of the people, but that their actions be directed within the boundaries of the Constitution. Because that Constitution belongs to the people, its champion, as George Washington perceived, should be a monarch whose obligation is not to politics or religion, but to the sovereign nation. Through the natural system of heredity, being born and bred to the task, such a constitutional guardian would provide an ongoing continuity of public representation through successive governments. In this regard, both monarchs and ministers would be servants of the Constitution on behalf of the community of the realm. Such a concept of moral government lies at the very heart of the Grail Code, and it remains within the bounds of possibility for every civilized nation state. A leading British politician recently claimed that it was not his job to be popular. Not so. A popular minister is a trusted minister, and holding a deserved electoral trust facilitates the democratic process. No minister can honestly expound an ideal of equality in society when that minister is deemed to possess some form of prior lordship over society. Class structure is always decided from above, never from below. It is therefore for those on self-made pedestals to be seen to kick them aside in the interests of harmony and unity. Jesus was not in the least humbled when he washed his apostles' feet. He was raised to the realm of a true Grail King, the realm of equality and princely service. This is the eternal precept of the Sangreal, and it is expressed in Grail lore with the utmost clarity. Only by asking, "Whom does the Grail serve?" will the wound of the Fisher King be healed and the wasteland returned to fertility. Thank you. confronted Ferdinand and Isabella once more, and this time he won their support. On August the 3rd, 1492, he set sail from Palos with three small ships, the Niña, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria. 8 months later, Columbus returned to Barcelona, but not with the anticipated silks and spices from the east. Instead, he was accompanied by six brown-skinned natives bearing pearls, strange fruits, gold, and exotic birds. He had discovered an exciting new world across the sea, and the Pope declared that these rich lands belonged to Spain. The name America did not emerge for another 5 years. It derived from the Florentine navigator Amerigo Vespucci, who sailed to the south continental mainland in 1497. What is almost unknown in the world is that representing Ferdinand and Isabella and the nation of Spain, Christopher Colombo should have planted the flag of Spain when he landed upon the first beach in his voyage. He should have claimed those lands for Spain, but he did not, ladies and gentlemen. He planted a white flag upon which was a green cross. Upon his return, Columbus related that he had landed on Watling Island, now San Salvador in the Bahamas. He had also visited Hispaniola, Haiti, and the Dominican Republic, and Cuba. Ferdinand and Isabella were delighted, and their hero was offered a seat at the Spanish court. His second voyage, 1493 to 1496, took him to Guadalupe, Antigua, Puerto Rico, and Jamaica. The third voyage of 1498 saw Columbus in Trinidad and on the mainland of South America. Then, in 1499, the colonists of Haiti revolted against his command. Consequently, a new Spanish governor was installed, and Columbus was shipped back to Europe in chains. His last voyage, in 1502 to 1504, concerned the coastal exploration of Honduras and Nicaragua. But despite his hour of glory, he died in poverty 2 years later at Valladolid, and Columbus was buried at Seville in 1542. His remains were eventually removed to Hispaniola. Now, this exciting piece of maritime history is well enough known, at least, you know, by a lot of people. What is not so well known is the fact that the New World discovery was no accident. You see, Columbus was fully armed with detailed navigational charts before he set sail. He knew there was land there. He had maps that showed the land. They had been drawn up on previous Atlantic crossings and were vouched for at the Spanish court by John Drummond, whose grandfather had been to America in 1398. Drummond was related to the Drummond Earls of Perth, where the records confirm that he was with Ferdinand and Isabella in 1492. Both Columbus and Drummond had lived on the island of Madeira. Drummond's father, John, the Scot Drummond, had settled there in 1419 along with Columbus's father-in-law, Bartholomew Perestrello. John, the Scot's father, was Sir John Drummond of Stobhall, justiciar of Scotland. Sir John's sister Annabella was the wife of King Robert III, Stuart of Scots. Sir John's own wife was Elizabeth Sinclair, whose nephew, William Sinclair, was the founder of Roslyn Chapel. Elizabeth's father, Henry Sinclair, Baron of Roslyn, Earl of Orkney, led a successful transatlantic expedition nearly a century before Columbus, and even he was not the first. Henry Sinclair's Norse ancestors had explored the Atlantic as far back as the 10th century. In Hauk's Book of the Icelandic Saga, extant copy dated 1320, Leif Erikson is detailed as having crossed the Atlantic to Wineland the Good in 999. Indeed, the Orkney sailors had reached land to the west within Henry's own lifetime. Their reports claimed that the natives of a faraway place called Estotilands sowed corn and exported furs and sulfur to Greenland. Estotilands was the place eventually called Nova Scotia, or New Scotland, in Canada. The Orkney sailors also told of a southern country called Drogheo. The natives of Drogheo ran naked in the hot winds, but across the sea, the people were very refined. Their land was rich in gold, and they had cities and great temples to their gods. Now, these various accounts were all confirmed when voyagers traveled to the Caribbean islands and onwards to Florida and Mexico, the home of the Aztec Indians. In complete disregard of these early discoveries, tradition has it that the Aztec Empire was not explored until the Spanish conquistador Hernan Cortes arrived there in 1519. Well, from 1391, the master of Sinclair's fleet was the Venetian sea captain Antonio Zeno. The Zenos were among the oldest families of Venice and were noted admirals and ambassadors from the 8th century. Before Sinclair and Zeno made their own passage across the ocean, Henry drew up a contract with his daughter Elizabeth and her husband, Sir John Drummond. The deed was sealed at Roslyn on May 13, 1396. It empowered Sir John and Elizabeth to claim Henry's Norwegian lands if he and his sons should perish in the expedition. An account of the Sinclair-Zeno voyage is to be found in Andrew Sinclair's The Sword and the Grail, pages 108 through 150. In May 1398, the Sinclair fleet set sail. There were 12 warships and 100 men, some of whom had made the voyage before. Their first port of call was Nova Scotia, where they landed at Cape Blomidon in the Bay of Fundy. Now, even today, the Mi'kmaq Indians tell of the incoming ships of the great god Coolscap, who taught them about the stars and how to fish with nets. On his return home to Venice, Antonio Zeno wrote that at this place he had seen streams of pitch running into the sea and a mountain that issued smoke from its base. Now, Nova Scotia is certainly very rich in coal, and there are exposed coastal seams of pitch where the coal brooks run at asphalt. Nearby, the greasy underground residues often smolder beneath the hills of Cape Smoky. At Louisbourg on Cape Breton, there is a primitive cannon found in 1849. It is of the Venetian type, used by Zeno, and, ladies and gentlemen, it is of a style that was quite obsolete by the time of Columbus. From Nova Scotia, Sinclair continued south towards the land of Drogheo. Evidence of the journey can be seen at Massachusetts and Rhode Island. At Westford, Massachusetts, where one of Henry's knights died, the grave is still discernible. And punched into a rock ledge is the 7-foot effigy of a 14th century knight wearing a bassinet, chain mail, and a surcoat. The figure bears a sword of the 1300s and a shield with Pentland heraldry. The knight's sword is broken below the hilt, indicative of the customary broken sword that would have been buried with the knight, the same as was laid before Percival in Grail lore. At Newport, Rhode Island, is a well-preserved two-story medieval tower. Its construction, an octagon within a circle and 8 arches around, is based on the circular model of the Templar churches. Similar remains are to be found at the 12th century Orphir Chapel in Orkney. The Newport architecture is Scottish, and its design is reproduced at the St. Clair Church. Corstorphine, where Henry Sinclair's daughter has her memorial. Rhode Island was not officially founded until 1636, but its founding was no chance event. At the Public Records Office in London, a text dated 4 years earlier describes the round stone tower at Newport. It proposed that the tower be used as a garrison for the soldiers of Sir Edmund Plowden, who colonized that area. Now, more than 50 years after the Sinclair expedition, Christopher Columbus was born into the high age of discovery in Europe. In Portugal, he became a Knight of Christ in the revised Templar order, as did his famous contemporaries Vasco da Gama, Bartolomeu Dias, and Ferdinand Magellan. In short, he was a Knight Templar. He also belonged to the Order of the Crescent, founded by René d'Anjou, also known as the Order of the Ship. The Crescent Knights were particularly concerned with matters of navigation, but had been condemned by the Church for insisting on a very, very minor point, the point that the world was round. Through John Drummond and others, Columbus knew precisely where he was heading, and it was not to Asia. Maps of the transatlantic New World were already in existence within his Templar circle. In particular, he had access to the new Globe of the World, which was completed in 1492, precisely the year that he set sail. This globe was produced by the Nuremberg cartographer Martin Behaim. He was a navigational business partner of John Afonso Escoricio, better known, ladies and gentlemen, as John Drummond. It is no secret, although perhaps it's not the most widely known fact, that the early development of Masonic lodges in Britain, was directly allied to the House of Stuart, emanating from the archetypal grading of medieval stonemasons by degrees of proficiency, which was a symbolic concept of ritualized masonry evolved during the reign of Charles I. The earliest inductions into free or speculative Masonic lodges were recorded in about 1640. The movement was largely concerned with the structured acquisition of knowledge in unexplained science, much of which had been preserved in Scotland since the time of the original Templars and Cistercian monks. In Stuart England, the early Freemasons of Charles I and Charles II were men of philosophy, astronomy, physics, architecture, chemistry, and generally advanced learning. Many were members of the country's most important scientific academy, the Royal Society, which had been styled the Invisible College after it was forced underground during the Cromwellian Protectorate. The Society was established under Charles I in 1645 and incorporated under Royal Charter by Charles II in 1662 after the Restoration. Early members included Robert Boyle, Isaac Newton, Robert Hooke, Christopher Wren, and Samuel Pepys. Now, one only has to consider the accomplishments of the Royal Society to realize that, like the early Templars, they were endowed with very special knowledge. The natural philosopher Robert Boyle, 1627 to 1691, was a noted alchemist, a student of Nostradamus, and a leading authority on Grail lore. Boyle supported the mathematical astrologer Galileo Galilei in his avowal of the Copernican heliocentric principle of the solar system, which the Pope didn't much care for. He made many discoveries concerning the properties of air, and of course formulated the very notable Boyle's Law. His colleague, the physicist Robert Hooke, 1635 to 1703, invented the hairspring, the double air pump, the spirit level, and the marine barometer. Also in the fraternity was the astronomer and geometrician Edmund Halley, who calculated the motion of celestial bodies and accurately predicted the future regular reappearances of Halley's Comet. Isaac Newton, 1642 to 1727, was one of the greatest scientists of all time, renowned in particular for announcing the law of gravity and the definitions of orbital force. He was a noted alchemist, a refiner of the calculus, deviser of the laws of motion, and inventor of the reflecting telescope. One of Newton's foremost studies concerned the structure of the ancient kingdoms, and he claimed the preeminence of the Judaic heritage as an archive of divine knowledge and numerology. Newton was wholly conversant with universal law, sacred geometry, and Gothic architecture. Although he was a deeply spiritual man and an authority on early religion, he openly rejected the Trinity dogma and the divinity of Jesus, maintaining that the New Testament had been distorted by the church before its publication. Not only was Newton the president of the Royal Society, but he was also a grand helmsman of the Priory Notre Dame de Sion. The original order of Sion had been inaugurated by the Knights Templars to accommodate Jews and Muslims within their Christian organization, and until 1188 they shared the same Grand Master. Although the early Templars had a Christian affiliation, they were noted exponents of religious toleration, which enabled them to be influential diplomats in both the Jewish and Islamic communities. However, their liberal association with Jews and Muslims was denounced as heresy by the Catholic bishops and was instrumental in the Knights' excommunication by the Church of Rome in 1306. From 1188, the Order of Sion had been restructured and evolved to pursue a more specific course of loyalty to the Merovingian lineage of France. The Templars, on the other hand, were especially concerned with supporting the emergent Stuart succession. In practice, the two operated in close association because they were essentially concerned with the same root bloodline. Another prominent Royal Society member was Sir Christopher Wren, 1632 to 1723, the architect of St. Paul's Cathedral, the Royal Exchange, Greenwich Hospital, the Royal Naval College, the Royal Greenwich Observatory, and numerous other churches, halls, and monuments. He was also an acclaimed He was also an acclaimed mathematician and a professor of astronomy. Wren was Grand Master of the Esoteric Order of Rosicrucians. So too had been Robert Boyle and the Lord Chancellor Sir Francis Bacon. Other Rosicrucian grandmasters included Benjamin Franklin, 1706 to 1790, who distinguished between positive and negative electricity, and Thomas Jefferson, the third president of the United States of America, term of office 1801 to 1809. Benjamin Franklin was also the master of the Lodge of Nine Muses. While he was a diplomatic representative of the United States to France and England. Modern historians have an unfortunate habit of extolling certain virtues of such great and learned men while paying absolutely no attention to the root sources of their wisdom. They are explicitly described as artists, scientists, politicians, or whatever, but from Leonardo to Newton, and from Newton to Franklin, their common interests were hermetic alchemy. They were deists, and they engaged in what they called the sacred craft. In fact, their various revelations were not necessarily first-time discoveries. They were more the products of studying what they called cosmic laws and equations of very ancient origin. As an organized group, the men were able to assist each other with translation, experiment, and the development. The story of Newton and the falling apple may well add a little memorable humor to the law of gravity, but Newton admitted the true source of this inspiration to be Pythagoras' music of the spheres, a concept dating from the 6th century BC. In Britain, and during their later exile, the Stuart kings were at the very forefront of Scottish Rite Freemasonry, which was founded on the most ancient of all arcane knowledge and universal law. Their Breton heritage was closely allied to the noble families of Boulogne and Jerusalem, and their background was largely Templar-inspired. So it should come as no surprise that it was under Charles I and Charles II, who posed such a problem to the narrow-minded Puritans in the Anglican Church, that the invisible college of the Royal Society emerged, a college that within a brief period of Stuart patronage revealed some of the greatest scientific discoveries of all time, and in modern times spawned the Royal Institute of International Affairs and the Council on Foreign Relations. Good night, ladies and gentlemen, and God bless each and every single one of you. And, if you can afford it, get this book that this book review broadcast was all about, Bloodline of the Holy Grail, The Hidden Lineage of Jesus Revealed, by Lawrence Gardner. Doesn't matter whether you believe this guy or not, you'd better understand the scam that the Illuminati is attempting to pull off on the world. And you would be absolutely amazed at how many people actually believe all of this baloney to be true. It is, in fact, an international bestseller. Thank you. You've been listening to The Hour of the Time with yours truly, William Cooper, on 101.1 FM Eager, a non-profit community service radio station, and worldwide on WRMI, Worldwide Shortwave Radio, 9.955 megahertz.